Chapter 6. The address communicated by Mrs. Todd took me to a lodging house situated in a respectable street near the Gray's Inn Road. When I knocked, the door was opened by Mrs. Clemens herself. She did not appear to remember me, and asked what my business was. I recalled to her our meeting in Limeridge Churchyard at the close of my interview there with the woman in white, taking special care to remind her that I was the person who assisted Anne Catherick, as Anne had herself declared, to escape the pursuit from the asylum. This was my only claim to the confidence of Mrs. Clements. She remembered the circumstance the moment I spoke of it, and asked me into the parlour in the greatest anxiety to know if I had brought her any news of Anne. It was impossible for me to tell her the whole truth without, at the same time, entering into particulars on the subject of the conspiracy which it would have been dangerous to confide to a stranger. I could only abstain most carefully from raising any false hopes, and then explain that the object of my visit was to discover the persons who were really responsible for Anne's disappearance. I even added, so as to exonerate myself from any after reproach of my own conscience, that I entertained not the least hope of being able to trace her, that I believed we should never see her alive again, and that my main interest in the affair was to bring to punishment two men whom I suspected to be concerned in luring her away, and at whose hands I and some dear friends of mine had suffered a grievous wrong. With this explanation, I left it to Mrs. Clemens to say whether our interests in the matter, whatever difference there might be in the motives which actuated us, was not the same, and whether she felt any reluctance to forward my object by giving me such information on the subject of my inquiries as she happened to possess. The poor woman was at first too much confused and agitated to understand thoroughly what I said to her. She could only reply that I was welcome to anything she could tell me in return for the kindness I had shown to Anne. But as she was not very quick and ready at the best of times in talking to strangers, she would beg me to put her in the right way and to say where I wished her to begin. Knowing by experience that the plainest narrative attainable from persons who are not accustomed to arrange their ideas is the narrative which goes far enough back at the beginning to avoid all impediments of retrospection in its course, I asked Mrs. Clemens to tell me, first, what had happened after she had left Limeridge, and so, by watchful questioning, carried her on from point to point till we reached the period of Anne's disappearance. The substance of the information which I thus obtained was as follows. On leaving the farm at Todd's Corner, Mrs. Clemens and Anne had travelled that day as far as Derby, and had remained there a week on Anne's account. They had then gone on to London, and had lived in the lodging occupied by Mrs. Clemens at that time for a month or more, when circumstances connected with the house and the landlord had obliged them to change their quarters. Anne's terror of being discovered in London, or its neighbourhood, whenever they ventured to walk out, had gradually communicated itself to Mrs. Clemens, and she had determined on removing to one of the most out-of-the-way places in England, to the town of Grimsby in Lincolnshire, where her deceased husband had passed all his early life. His relatives were respectable people settled in the town. They had always treated Mrs. Clemens with great kindness, and she thought it impossible to do better than go there and take the advice of her husband's friends. Anne would not hear of returning to her mother at Welmingham, because she had been removed to the asylum from that place, and because Sir Percival would be certain to go back there and find her again. There was serious weight in this objection, and Mrs. Clemens felt that it was not to be easily removed. At Grimsby, the first serious symptoms of illness had shown themselves in Anne. They appeared soon after the news of Lady Glyde's marriage had been made public in the newspapers, and had reached her through that medium. The medical man who was sent for to attend the sick woman discovered at once that she was suffering from a serious affection of the heart. The illness lasted long, left her very weak, and returned at intervals, though with mitigated severity, again and again. They remained at Grimsby in consequence during the first half of the new year, and there they might probably have stayed much longer, but for the sudden resolution which Anne took at this time to venture back to Hampshire for the purpose of obtaining a private interview with Lady Glyde. Mrs. Clemens did all in her power to oppose the execution of this hazardous and unaccountable project. No explanation of her motives was offered by Anne, except that she believed the day of her death was not far off, and that she had something on her mind which must be communicated to Lady Glyde at any risk in secret. Her resolution to accomplish this purpose was so firmly settled that she declared her intention of going to Hampshire by herself if Mrs. Clemens felt any unwillingness to go with her. The doctor, on being consulted, was of opinion that serious opposition to her wishes would in all probability produce another and perhaps a fatal fit of illness, and Mrs. Clements, under this advice, yielded to necessity, and once more, with sad forebodings of trouble and danger to come, allowed Anne Catherick to have her own way. On the journey from London to Hampshire, Mrs. Clements discovered that one of their fellow passengers was well acquainted with the neighbourhood of Blackwater, and could give her all the information she needed on the subject of localities. In this way, she found out that the only place they could go to which was not dangerously near to Sir Percival's residence was a large village called Sandon. The distance here from Blackwater Park was between 3 and 4 miles, and that distance and back again Anne had walked on each occasion when she had appeared in the neighbourhood of the lake. For the few days during which they were at Sandon without being discovered, they had lived a little way from the village in the cottage of a decent widow woman who had a bedroom to let and whose discreet silence Mrs. Clements had done her best to secure for the first week at least. She had also tried hard to induce Anne to be content with writing to Lady Glyde in the first instance. But the failure of the warning contained in the anonymous letter sent to Limeridge had made Anne resolute to speak this time, and obstinate in the determination to go on her errand alone. Mrs. Clements, nevertheless, followed her privately on each occasion when she went to the lake, without, however, venturing near enough to the boathouse to be witness of what took place there. When Anne returned for the last time from the dangerous neighbourhood, the fatigue of walking day after day distances which were far too great for her strength, added to the exhausting effect of the agitation from which she had suffered, produced the result which Mrs. Clements had dreaded all along. The old pain over the heart and the other symptoms of the illness at Grimsby returned, and Anne was confined to her bed in the cottage. In this emergency, the first necessity, as Mrs. Clements knew by experience, was to endeavour to quiet Anne's anxiety of mind, and for this purpose the good woman went herself the next day to the lake to try if she could find Lady Glyde, who would be sure, as Anne said, to take her daily walk to the boathouse, and prevail on her to come back privately to the cottage near Sandon. On reaching the outskirts of the plantation, Mrs. Clements encountered not Lady Glyde, but a tall, stout, elderly gentleman with a book in his hand. In other words, Count Fosco. The Count, after looking at her very attentively for a moment, asked if she expected to see anyone in that place, and added, before she could reply, that he was waiting there with a message from Lady Glyde, but that he was not quite certain whether the person then before him answered the description of the person with whom he was desired to communicate. Upon this, Mrs. Clements at once confided her errand to him, and entreated that he would help to allay Anne's anxiety by trusting his message to her. The Count most readily and kindly complied with her request. The message, he said, was a most important one. Lady Glyde entreated Anne and her good friend to return immediately to London, as she felt certain that Sir Percival would discover them if they remained any longer in the neighbourhood of Blackwater. She was herself going to London in a short time, and if Mrs. Clements and Anne would go there first, and would let her know what their address was, they should hear from her and see her in a fortnight or less. The Count added that he had already attempted to give a friendly warning to Anne herself, but that she had been too much startled by seeing that he was a stranger to let him approach and speak to her. To this, Mrs. Clements replied, in the greatest alarm and distress, that she asked nothing better than to take Anne safely to London, but that there was no present hope of removing her from the dangerous neighbourhood, as she lay ill in her bed at that moment. The Count inquired if Mrs. Clements had sent for medical advice, and hearing that she had hitherto hesitated to do so, from the fear of making their position publicly known in the village, informed her that he was himself a medical man, and that he would go back with her, if she pleased, to see what could be done for Anne. Mrs. Clements, feeling a natural confidence in the Count as a person trusted with a secret message from Lady Glyde, gratefully accepted the offer, and they went back together to the cottage. Anne was asleep when they got there. The Count started at the sight of her, evidently from astonishment at her resemblance to Lady Glyde. Poor Mrs. Clements supposed that he was only shocked to see how ill she was. He would not allow her to be awakened. He was contented with putting questions to Mrs. Clements about her symptoms, with looking at her, and with lightly touching her pulse. Sandon was a large enough place to have a grocer's and druggist's shop in it, and thither the Count went to write his prescription and to get the medicine made up. He brought it back himself, and told Mrs. Clements that the medicine was a powerful stimulant, and that it would certainly give Anne strength to get up and bear the fatigue of a journey to London of only a few hours. The remedy was to be administered at stated times on that day and on the day after. On the third day, she would be well enough to travel, and he arranged to meet Mrs. Clements at the Blackwater station and to see them off by the midday train. If they did not appear, he would assume that Anne was worse and would proceed at once to the cottage. As events turned out, no such emergency as this occurred. The medicine had an extraordinary effect on Anne, and the good results of it were helped by the assurance Mrs. Clements could now give her that she would soon see Lady Glyde in London. At the appointed day and time, when they had not been quite so long as a week in Hampshire altogether, they arrived at the station. The Count was waiting there for them, and was talking to an elderly lady who appeared to be going to travel by the train to London also. He most kindly assisted them, and put them into the carriage himself, begging Mrs. Clements not to forget to send her address to Lady Glyde. The elderly lady did not travel in the same compartment, and they did not notice what became of her on reaching the London terminus. Mrs. Clements secured respectable lodgings in a quiet neighbourhood, and then wrote, as she had engaged to do, to inform Lady Glyde of the address. A little more than a fortnight passed, and no answer came. At the end of that time, a lady, the same elderly lady whom they had seen at the station, called in a cab, and said that she came from Lady Glyde, who was then at an hotel in London, and who wished to see Mrs. Clements for the purpose of arranging a future interview with Anne. Mrs. Clements expressed her willingness, Anne being present at the time and entreating her to do so, to forward the object in view, especially as she was not required to be away from the house for more than half an hour at the most. She and the elderly lady, clearly Madame Fosco, then left in the cab. The lady stopped the cab, after it had driven some distance, at a shop before they got to the hotel, and begged Mrs. Clements to wait for her for a few minutes while she made a purchase that had been forgotten. She never appeared again. After waiting some time, Mrs. Clements became alarmed and ordered the cabman to drive back to her lodgings. When she got there, after an absence of rather more than half an hour, Anne was gone. The only information to be obtained from the people of the house was derived from the servant who waited on the lodgers. She had opened the door to a boy from the street who had left a letter for the young woman who lived on the second floor, the part of the house which Mrs. Clements occupied. The servant had delivered the letter, had then gone downstairs, and 5 minutes afterwards had observed Anne open the front door and go out, dressed in her bonnet and shawl. She had probably taken the letter with her, for it was not to be found, and it was therefore impossible to tell what inducement had been offered to make her leave the house. It must have been a strong one, for she would never stir out alone in London of her own accord. If Mrs. Clements had not known this by experience, nothing would have induced her to go away in the cab, even for so short a time as half an hour only. As soon as she could collect her thoughts, the first idea that naturally occurred to Mrs. Clements was to go and make inquiries at the asylum, to which she dreaded that Anne had been taken back. She went there the next day, having been informed of the locality in which the house was situated by Anne herself. The answer she received, her application having in all probability been made a day or two before the false Anne Catherick had really been consigned to safekeeping in the asylum, was that no such person had been brought back there. She had then written to Mrs. Catherick at Welmingham to know if she had seen or heard anything of her daughter, and had received an answer in the negative. After that reply had reached her, she was at the end of her resources, and perfectly ignorant where else to inquire or what else to do. From that time to this, she had remained in total ignorance of the cause of Anne's disappearance and of the end of Anne's story. Thus far, the information which I had received from Mrs. Clements, though it established facts of which I had not previously been aware, was of a preliminary character only. It was clear that the series of deceptions which had removed Anne Catherick to London and separated her from Mrs. Clements had been accomplished solely by Count Fosco and the Countess, and the question whether any part of the conduct of husband or wife had been of a kind to place either of them within reach of the law might be well worthy of future consideration. But the purpose I had now in view led me in another direction than this. The immediate object of my visit to Mrs. Clements was to make some approach at least to the discovery of Sir Percival's secret. and she had said nothing as yet which advanced me on my way to that important end. I felt the necessity of trying to awaken her recollections of other times, persons, and events than those on which her memory had hitherto been employed, and when I next spoke, I spoke with that object indirectly in view. "I wish I could be of any help to you in this sad calamity," I said. "All I can do is to feel heartily for your distress. If Anne had been your own child, Mrs. Clements, you could have shown her no truer kindness. You could have made no readier sacrifices for her sake." "There is no great merit in that, sir," said Mrs. Clements simply. "The poor thing was as good as my own child to me. I nursed her from a baby, sir, bringing her up by hand, and a hard job it was to rear her. It wouldn't go to my heart so to lose her if I hadn't made her first short clothes and taught her to walk. I always said she was sent to console me for never having chick or child of my own, and now she's lost. The old times keep coming back to my mind, and even at my age, I can't help crying about her. I can't indeed, sir." I waited a little to give Mrs. Clements time to compose herself. Was the light that I had been looking for so long glimmering on me, far off as yet, in the good woman's recollections of Anne's early life? "Did you know Mrs. Catherick before Anne was born?" I asked. "Not very long, sir. Not above 4 months. We saw a great deal of each other in that time, but we were never very friendly together." Her voice was steadier as she made that reply. Painful as many of her recollections might be, I observed that it was unconsciously a relief to her mind to revert to the dimly seen troubles of the past, after dwelling so long on the vivid sorrows of the present. "Were you and Mrs. Catherick neighbours?" I inquired, leading her memory on, as encouragingly as I could. "Yes, sir. Neighbours at Old Welmingham."
"Old Welmingham?"
There are two places of that name, then, in Hampshire."
"Well, sir, there used to be in those days, better than 23 years ago. They built a new town about 2 miles off, convenient to the river, and Old Welmingham, which was never much more than a village, got in time to be deserted."
"The new town is the place they call Welmingham now, but the old parish church is the parish church still. It stands by itself, with the houses pulled down or gone to ruin all round it. I've lived to see sad changes. It was a pleasant, pretty place in my time."
"Did you live there before your marriage, Mrs. Clements?"
"No, sir. I'm a Norfolk woman. It wasn't the place my husband belonged to either. He was from Grimsby, as I told you, and he served his apprenticeship there. But having friends down south and hearing of an opening, he got into business at Southampton. It was in a small way, but he made enough for a plain man to retire on and settled at Old Welmingham. I went there with him when he married me. We were neither of us young, but we lived very happy together. Happier than our neighbour, Mr. Catherick, lived along with his wife when they came to Old Welmingham a year or two afterwards."
"Was your husband acquainted with them before that?"
"With Catherick, sir, not with his wife. She was a stranger to both of us. Some gentleman had made interest for Catherick, and he got the situation of clerk at Welmingham Church, which was the reason of his coming to settle in our neighbourhood. He brought his newly married wife along with him, and we heard in course of time she had been lady's maid in a family that lived at Varnick Hall, near Southampton. Catherick had found it a hard matter to get her to marry him, in consequence of her holding herself uncommonly high. He had asked and asked and given the thing up at last, seeing she was so contrary about it. When he had given it up, she turned contrary just the other way, and came to him of her own accord, without rhyme or reason, seemingly. My poor husband always said that that was the time to have given her a lesson, but Catherick was too fond of her to do anything of the sort. He never checked her, either before they were married or after. He was a quick man in his feelings, letting them carry him a deal too far, now in one way and now in another, and he would have spoiled a better wife than Mrs. Catherick if a better had married him. I don't like to speak ill of anyone, sir, but she was a heartless woman with a terrible will of her own, fond of foolish admiration and fine clothes, and not caring to show so much as decent outward respect to Catherick, kindly as he always treated her. My husband said he thought things would turn out badly when they first came to live near us, and his words proved true. Before they had been quite 4 months in our neighbourhood, there was a dreadful scandal and a miserable break-up in their household. Both of them were in fault. I'm afraid both of them were equally in fault."
"You mean both husband and wife?"
"Oh, no, sir, I don't mean Catherick.
He was only to be pitied. I meant his wife and the person...
And the person who caused the scandal?
Yes, sir. A gentleman, born and brought up, who ought to have set a better example.
Oh, you know him, sir, and my poor dear Anne knew him only too well.
Sir Percival Glyde?
Yes, Sir Percival Glyde.
My heart beat fast. I thought I had my hand on the clue. How little I knew then of the windings of the labyrinth which were still to mislead me.
Did Sir Percival live in your neighbourhood at that time, I asked?
No, sir. He came among us as a stranger. His father had died not long before in foreign parts. I remember he was in mourning. He put up at the little inn on the river, they've pulled it down since that time, where gentlemen used to go to fish. He wasn't much noticed when he first came. It was a common thing enough for gentlemen to travel from all parts of England to fish in our river.
Did he make his appearance in the village before Anne was born?
Yes, sir. Anne was born in the June month of 1827, and I think he came at the end of April or the beginning of May.
Came as a stranger to all of you?
A stranger to Mrs. Catherick as well as to the rest of the neighbours?
So we thought at first, sir, but when the scandal broke out, nobody believed they were strangers. I remember how it happened, as well as if it was yesterday. Catherick came into our garden one night and woke us by throwing up a handful of gravel from the walk at our window. I heard him beg my husband, for the Lord's sake, to come down and speak to him. They were a long time together talking in the porch. When my husband came back upstairs, he was all of a tremble. He sat down on the side of the bed and he says to me, "Lizzie, I always told you that woman was a bad one. I always said she would end ill, and I'm afraid, in my own mind, that the end has already come. Catherick has found a lot of lace handkerchiefs and two fine rings and a new gold watch and chain hid away in his wife's drawer, things that nobody but a born lady ought ever to have, and his wife won't say how she came by them."
"What, does he think she stole them?" says I.
"No," says he. "Stealing would be bad enough, but it's worse than that. She's had no chance of stealing such things as those, and she's not a woman to take them if she had. They're gifts, Lizzie. There's her own initials engraved inside the watch, and Catherick has seen her talking privately and carrying on as no married woman should with that gentleman in mourning, Sir Percival Glyde. Don't you say anything about it. I've quieted Catherick for tonight. I've told him to keep his tongue to himself and his eyes and his ears open, and to wait a day or two till he can be quite certain. I believe you are both of you wrong," says I. "It's not in nature, comfortable and respectable as she is here, that Mrs. Catherick should take up with a chance stranger like Sir Percival Glyde."
"Aye, but is he a stranger to her?" says my husband. "You forget how Catherick's wife came to marry him. She went to him of her own accord, after saying no over and over again when he asked her. There have been wicked women before her time, Lizzie, who have used honest men who loved them as a means of saving their characters, and I'm sorely afraid this Mrs. Catherick is as wicked as the worst of them."
"We shall see," says my husband. "We shall soon see." And only 2 days afterwards we did see.
Mrs. Clements waited for a moment before she went on. Even in that moment I began to doubt whether the clue that I thought I had found was really leading me to the central mystery of the labyrinth after all. Was this common, too common, story of a man's treachery and a woman's frailty the key to a secret which had been the lifelong terror of Sir Percival Glyde?
"Well, sir, Catherick took my husband's advice and waited," Mrs. Clements continued. "And as I told you, he hadn't long to wait. On the second day, he found his wife and Sir Percival whispering together, quite familiar, close under the vestry of the church. I suppose they thought the neighbourhood of the vestry was the last place in the world where anybody would think of looking after them. But however that may be, there they were."
Sir Percival, being seemingly surprised and confounded, defended himself in such a guilty way that poor Catherick, whose quick temper I have told you of already, fell into a kind of frenzy at his own disgrace and struck Sir Percival. He was no match, and I am sorry to say it, for the man who had wronged him, and he was beaten in the cruelest manner before the neighbours who had come to the place on hearing the disturbance could run in to part them. All this happened towards evening, and before nightfall, when my husband went to Catherick's house, he was gone. Nobody knew where. No living soul in the village ever saw him again. He knew too well by that time what his wife's vile reason had been for marrying him, and he felt his misery and disgrace, especially after what had happened to him with Sir Percival, too keenly. The clergyman of the parish put an advertisement in the paper, begging him to come back, and saying that he should not lose his situation or his friends. But Catherick had too much pride and spirit, as some people said, too much feeling, as I think, sir, to face his neighbours again and try to live down the memory of his disgrace. My husband heard from him when he had left England, and heard a second time when he was settled and doing well in America. He is alive there now, as far as I know. But none of us in the old country, his wicked wife least of all, are ever likely to set eyes on him again. "What became of Sir Percival?" I inquired. "Did he stay in the neighbourhood?" "Not he, sir. The place was too hot to hold him. He was heard at high words with Mrs. Catherick the same night when the scandal broke out, and the next morning he took himself off."
"And Mrs. Catherick?"
"Surely she never remained in the village among the people who knew of her disgrace."
"She did, sir.
She was hard enough and heartless enough to set the opinions of all her neighbours at flat defiance. She declared to everybody, from the clergyman downwards, that she was the victim of a dreadful mistake, and that all the scandal-mongers in the place should not drive her out of it as if she was a guilty woman. All through my time she lived at Old Welmingham, and after my time, when the new town was building and the respectable neighbours began moving to it, she moved too, as if she was determined to live among them and scandalise them to the very last. There she is now, and there she will stop, in defiance of the best of them, to her dying day."
"But how has she lived through all these years?" I asked. "Was her husband able and willing to help her?"
"Both able and willing, sir," said Mrs. Clements. "In the second letter he wrote to my good man, he said, 'She had borne his name and lived in his home, and wicked as she was, she must not starve like a beggar in the street. He could afford to make her some small allowance, and she might draw for it quarterly at a place in London.'"
"Did she accept the allowance?"
"Not a farthing of it, sir. She said she would never be beholden to Catherick for bit or drop if she lived to be 100, and she has kept her word ever since. When my poor dear husband died and left all to me, Catherick's letter was put in my possession with the other things, and I told her to let me know if she was ever in want. 'I'll let all England know I'm in want,' she said, 'before I tell Catherick or any friend of Catherick's. Take that for your answer, and give it to him for an answer if he ever writes again.'"
"Do you suppose that she had money of her own?"
"Very little, if any, sir. It was said, and said truly, I'm afraid, that her means of living came privately from Sir Percival Glyde."
After that last reply, I waited a little to reconsider what I had heard. If I unreservedly accepted the story so far, it was now plain that no approach, direct or indirect, to the secret had yet been revealed to me, and that the pursuit of my object had ended again in leaving me face to face with the most palpable and the most disheartening failure. But there was one point in the narrative which made me doubt the propriety of accepting it unreservedly, and which suggested the idea of something hidden below the surface. I could not account to myself for the circumstance of the clerk's guilty wife voluntarily living out all her after existence on the scene of her disgrace. The woman's own reported statement that she had taken this strange course as a practical assertion of her innocence did not satisfy me. It seemed, to my mind, more natural and more probable to assume that she was not so completely a free agent in this matter as she had herself asserted. In that case, who was the likeliest person to possess the power of compelling her to remain at Welmingham? The person unquestionably from whom she derived the means of living. She had refused assistance from her husband. She had no adequate resources of her own. She was a friendless, degraded woman. From what source should she derive help but from the source at which report pointed? Sir Percival Glyde. Reasoning on these assumptions, and always bearing in mind the one certain fact to guide me that Mrs. Catherick was in possession of the secret, I easily understood that it was Sir Percival's interest to keep her at Welmingham, because her character in that place was certain to isolate her from all communication with female neighbours, and to allow her no opportunities of talking incautiously in moments of free intercourse with inquisitive bosom friends. But what was the mystery to be concealed? Not Sir Percival's infamous connection with Mrs. Catherick's disgrace, for the neighbours were the very people who knew of it. Not the suspicion that he was Anne's father, for Welmingham was the place in which that suspicion must inevitably exist. If I accepted the guilty appearances described to me as unreservedly as others had accepted them, if I drew from them the same superficial conclusion which Mr. Catherick and all his neighbours had drawn, where was the suggestion, in all that I had heard, of a dangerous secret between Sir Percival and Mrs. Catherick, which had been kept hidden from that time to this? And yet, in those stolen meetings, in those familiar whisperings between the clerk's wife and the gentleman in mourning, the clue to discovery existed beyond a doubt. Was it possible that appearances in this case had pointed one way while the truth lay all the while unsuspected in another direction? Could Mrs. Catherick's assertion that she was the victim of a dreadful mistake by any possibility be true? Or, assuming it to be false, could the conclusion which associated Sir Percival with her guilt have been founded in some inconceivable error? Had Sir Percival, by any chance, courted the suspicion that was wrong for the sake of diverting from himself some other suspicion that was right? Here, if I could find it, here was the approach to the secret, hidden deep under the surface of the apparently unpromising story which I had just heard. My next questions were now directed to the one object of ascertaining whether Mr. Catherick had or had not arrived truly at the conviction of his wife's misconduct. The answers I received from Mrs. Clements left me in no doubt whatever on that point. Mrs. Catherick had, on the clearest evidence, compromised her reputation while a single woman with some person unknown and had married to save her character. It had been positively ascertained by calculations of time and place, into which I need not enter particularly, that the daughter who bore her husband's name was not her husband's child. The next object of inquiry, whether it was equally certain that Sir Percival must have been the father of Anne, was beset by far greater difficulties. I was in no position to try the probabilities on one side or on the other in this instance by any better test than the test of personal resemblance. "I suppose you often saw Sir Percival when he was in your village," I said. "Yes, sir, very often," replied Mrs. Clements. "Did you ever observe that Anne was like him?" "She was not at all like him, sir." "Was she like her mother, then?" "Not like her mother either, sir. Mrs. Catherick was dark and full in the face." "Not like her mother, and not like her supposed father." I knew that the test by personal resemblance was not to be implicitly trusted, but, on the other hand, it was not to be altogether rejected on that account. Was it possible to strengthen the evidence by discovering any conclusive facts in relation to the lives of Mrs. Catherick and Sir Percival before they either of them appeared at Old Welmingham? When I asked my next questions, I put them with this view. "When Sir Percival first arrived in your neighbourhood," I said, "did you hear where he had come from last?" "No, sir. Some said from Blackwater Park and some said from Scotland, but nobody knew." "Was Mrs. Catherick living in service at Farneck Hall immediately before her marriage?" "Yes, sir." "And had she been long in her place?" 3 or 4 years, sir. I'm not quite certain which." "Did you ever hear the name of the gentleman to whom Farneck Hall belonged at that time?" "Yes, sir. His name was Major Donthorne." "Did Mr. Catherick, or did anyone else you knew, ever hear that Sir Percival was a friend of Major Donthorne's, or ever see Sir Percival in the neighbourhood of Varnick Hall?" "Catherick never did, sir, that I can remember, nor anyone else either that I know of." I noted down Major Donthorne's name and address on the chance that he might still be alive and that it might be useful at some future time to apply to him. Meanwhile, the impression on my mind was now decidedly adverse to the opinion that Sir Percival was Anne's father, and decidedly favourable to the conclusion that the secret of his stolen interviews with Mrs. Catherick was entirely unconnected with the disgrace which the woman had inflicted on her husband's good name. I could think of no further inquiries which I might make to strengthen this impression. I could only encourage Mrs. Clements to speak next of Anne's early days, and watch for any chance suggestion which might in this way offer itself to me. "I have not heard yet," I said, "how the poor child born in all this sin and misery came to be trusted, Mrs. Clements, to your care." "There was nobody else, sir, to take the little helpless creature in hand," replied Mrs. Clements.
The wicked mother seemed to hate it, as if the poor baby was in fault, from the day it was born. My heart was heavy for the child, and I made the offer to bring it up as tenderly as if it was my own.
Did Anne remain entirely under your care from that time?
Not quite entirely, sir. Mrs. Catherick had her whims and fancies about it at times, and used now and then to lay claim to the child as if she wanted to spite me for bringing it up. But these fits of hers never lasted for long. Poor little Anne was always returned to me, and was always glad to get back. Though she led but a gloomy life in my house, having no playmates like other children to brighten her up. Our longest separation was when her mother took her to Limeridge. Just at that time, I lost my husband, and I felt it was as well in that miserable affliction that Anne should not be in the house. She was between 10 and 11 years old then, slow at her lessons, poor soul, and not so cheerful as other children, but as pretty a little girl to look at, as you would wish to see. I waited at home till her mother brought her back, and then I made the offer to take her with me to London, the truth being, sir, that I could not find it in my heart to stop at old Welmingham after my husband's death. The place was so changed and so dismal to me.
And did Mrs. Catherick consent to your proposal?
No, sir. She came back from the north harder and bitterer than ever. Folks did say that she'd been obliged to ask Sir Percival's leave to go to begin with, and that she only went to nurse her dying sister at Limeridge because the poor woman was reported to have saved money, the truth being that she hardly left enough to bury her. These things may have soured Mrs. Catherick, likely enough, but however that may be, she wouldn't hear of my taking the child away. She seemed to like distressing us both by parting us. All I could do was to give Anne my direction and to tell her privately, if she was ever in trouble, to come to me. But years passed before she was free to come. I never saw her again, poor soul, till the night she escaped from the madhouse.
You know, Mrs. Clements, why Sir Percival Glyde shut her up?
I only know what Anne herself told me, sir. The poor thing used to ramble and wander about it sadly. She said her mother had got some secret of Sir Percival's to keep and had let it out to her long after I left Hampshire, and when Sir Percival found she knew it, he shut her up. But she never could say what it was when I asked her. All she could tell me was that her mother might be the ruin and destruction of Sir Percival if she chose. Mrs. Catherick may have let out just as much as that and no more. I am next to certain I should have heard the whole truth from Anne if she had really known it, as she pretended to do, and as she very likely fancied she did, poor soul. This idea had more than once occurred to my own mind. I had already told Marian that I doubted whether Laura was really on the point of making any important discovery when she and Anne Catherick were disturbed by Count Fosco at the boathouse. It was perfectly in character with Anne's mental affliction that she should assume an absolute knowledge of the secret on no better grounds than vague suspicion derived from hints which her mother had incautiously let drop in her presence. Sir Percival's guilty distrust would, in that case, infallibly inspire him with the false idea that Anne knew all from her mother, just as it had afterwards fixed in his mind the equally false suspicion that his wife knew all from Anne. The time was passing. The morning was wearing away. It was doubtful if I stayed longer whether I should hear anything more from Mrs. Clements that would be at all useful to my purpose. I had already discovered those local and family particulars in relation to Mrs. Catherick of which I had been in search, and I had arrived at certain conclusions entirely new to me which might immensely assist in directing the course of my future proceedings. I rose to take my leave and to thank Mrs. Clements for the friendly readiness she had shown in affording me information. "I'm afraid you must have thought me very inquisitive," I said. "I have troubled you with more questions than many people would have cared to answer." "You are heartily welcome, sir, to anything I can tell you," answered Mrs. Clements. She stopped and looked at me wistfully. "But I do wish," said the poor woman, "you could have told me a little more about Anne, sir. I thought I saw something in your face when you came in which looked as if you could. You can't think how hard it is not even to know whether she is living or dead. I could bear it better if I was only certain. You said you never expected we should see her alive again. Do you know, sir, do you know for truth that it has pleased God to take her?" I was not proof against this appeal. It would have been unspeakably mean and cruel of me if I had resisted it. I am afraid there is no doubt of the truth, I answered gently. I have the certainty in my own mind that her troubles in this world are over. The poor woman dropped into her chair and hid her face from me. Oh, sir, she said, how do you know it? Who can have told you? No one has told me, Mrs. Clemens. But I have reasons for feeling sure of it, reasons which I promise you shall know as soon as I can safely explain them. I am certain she was not neglected in her last moments. I am certain the heart complaint from which she suffered so sadly was the true cause of her death. You shall feel as sure of this as I do soon. You shall know before long that she is buried in a quiet country churchyard, in a pretty, peaceful place which you might have chosen for her yourself. Dead, said Mrs. Clemens. Dead, so young, and I am left to hear it. I made her first frocks. I taught her to walk. The first time she ever said mother, she said it to me. And now I am left and Anne is taken. Did you say, sir, said the poor woman, removing the handkerchief from her face and looking up at me for the first time, did you say that she had been nicely buried? Was it the sort of funeral she might have had if she had really been my own child? I assured her that it was. She seemed to take an inexplicable pride in my answer, to find a comfort in it which no other and higher considerations could afford. It would have broken my heart, she said simply, if Anne had not been nicely buried. But how do you know it, sir? Who told you? I once more entreated her to wait until I could speak to her unreservedly. You are sure to see me again, I said, for I have a favour to ask when you are a little more composed, perhaps in a day or two. Don't keep it waiting, sir, on my account, said Mrs. Clemens. Never mind my crying, if I can be of use. If you have anything on your mind to say to me, sir, please to say it now. I only wish to ask you one last question, I said. I only want to know Mrs. Catherick's address at Welmingham. My request so startled Mrs. Clemens that for the moment even the tidings of Anne's death seemed to be driven from her mind. Her tears suddenly ceased to flow, and she sat looking at me in blank amazement. For the Lord's sake, sir, she said, what do you want with Mrs. Catherick? I want this, Mrs. Clemens, I replied. I want to know the secret of those private meetings of hers with Sir Percival Glyde. There is something more in what you have told me of that woman's past conduct and of that man's past relations with her than you or any of your neighbours ever suspected. There is a secret we none of us know of between those two, and I am going to Mrs. Catherick with a resolution to find it out. Oh, think twice about it, sir, said Mrs. Clemens, rising in her earnestness and laying her hand on my arm. She's an awful woman. You don't know her as I do. Think twice about it. I'm sure your warning is kindly meant, Mrs. Clemens, but I am determined to see the woman, whatever comes of it. Mrs. Clemens looked at me anxiously in the face. I see your mind is made up, sir, she said. I will give you the address. I wrote it down in my pocketbook, and then took the good woman by the hand to say farewell. You shall hear from me soon, I said. You shall know all that I have promised to tell you. Mrs. Clement sighed and shook her head doubtfully. An old woman's advice is sometimes worth taking, sir, she said. Think twice before you go to Welmingham.